future. He has linkages to several powerful interests among the French banking families, and more among the merchants. He's also received at court and has some access to Louis's ear. In short, if he does not at present hold the power to command substantial sums of money and influence, he is likely to do so soon. He is also a member of not one, but two of the more powerful Highland clans. And the parties who wish the personage in question to return to Rome harbour a not unreasonable fear that this influence might be exerted in undesirable directions. So much better if your husband were to return, his good name restored, to his lands in Scotland, do you not think?
It's a thought, I said. It was also a bribe, and an attractive one. Sever all connection with Charles Stuart, and be free to return to Scotland and Lallybroch, without the risk of being hanged. The removal of a possibly troublesome supporter of the Stuarts, at no expense to the Crown, was an attractive proposition from the English side, too. I eyed the Duke, trying to figure out just where he fitted into the scheme of things. Ostensibly an envoy from George II, Elector of Hanover, and King, so long as James Stuart remained in Rome, of England, he could well have a dual purpose in his visit to France. To engage with Louis in the delicate exchange of civility and threat that constituted diplomacy, and simultaneously to quash the spectre of a fresh Jacobite rising. Several of Charles's usual coterie had disappeared of late, pleading the press of urgent business abroad. Bought off or scared away? I wondered. The bland countenance gave no clue to his thoughts. He pushed back the wig from a balding brow and scratched his head unself-consciously. "Do think about it, my dear," he urged. "And when you have thought, speak to your husband."
"Why don't you speak to him yourself?"
He shrugged and took more sausages, three this time.
"I find that so often men are more amenable to a word spoken from the home quarter, from one they trust, rather to what they may perceive as pressure from an outside source."
He smiled.
"There is the matter of pride to be considered. That must be handled delicately."
"And for delicate handling, well, they do talk of the woman's touch, do they not?" I hadn't had time to respond to this when a shout from the main stable jerked all heads in that direction. A horse was coming toward us, up the narrow alley between the main stable and the long open shed that held the forge. A Percheron colt, and a young one, no more than two or three, judging from the dappling of his hide. Even young Percherons are big, and the colt seemed huge as he blundered to and fro at a slow trot, tail lashing from side to side. Plainly the colt wasn't yet broken to a saddle. The massive shoulders twitched in an effort to dislodge the small form that straddled his neck, both hands buried deep in the thick black mane.
"Bloody hell! It's Fergus!"
The ladies, disturbed by the shouting, had all gotten to their feet by now and were peering interestedly at the sight. I didn't realize that the men had joined us until one woman said, "But how dangerous it seems! Surely the boy will be injured if he falls." "Well, if it doesn't hurt himself falling off, I'll attend to it directly once I've got my hands on the wee bugger," said a grim voice behind me. I turned to see Jamie peering over my head at the rapidly approaching horse.
"Should you get him off?" I asked.
He shook his head.
"No, let the horse take care of it."
In fact, the horse seemed more bewildered than frightened by the strange weight on his back. The dappled grey skin twitched and shivered as though beset by hordes of flies, and the colt shook its head confusedly, as though wondering what was going on. As for Fergus, his legs were stretched nearly at right angles across the Percheron's broad back. Clearly the only hold he had on the horse was his death grip on the mane. At that he might have managed to slide down, or at least tumble off unscathed, had the victims of the manure fight not completed their plan to exact a measure of revenge. Two or three grooms were following the horse at a cautious distance, blocking the alleyway behind it. Another had succeeded in running ahead and opening the gate to an empty paddock that stood near us. The gate was between the group of visiting picnickers and the end of the alleyway between the buildings. Clearly, the intention was to nudge the horse quietly into the paddock, where it could trample Fergus or not as it chose, but at least would itself be safe from escape or injury. Before this could be accomplished, though, a lithe form popped its head through a small loft window high above the alleyway. The spectators, intent on the horse, no one noticed but me. The boy in the loft observed, withdrew, and reappeared almost at once, holding a large flake of hay in both hands. Judging the moment to a nicety, he dropped it as Fergus and his mount passed directly beneath. The effect was much like a bomb going off. There was an explosion of hay where Fergus had been, and the colt gave a panicked whinny, got its hindquarters under it, and took off like a Derby winner, heading straight for the little knot of courtiers who scattered to the four winds, screeching like geese. Jamie had flung himself on me, pushing me out of the way and knocking me to the ground in the process. Now he rose off my supine form, cursing fluently in Gaelic. Without pausing to inquire after my welfare, he raced off in the direction taken by Fergus. The horse was rearing and twisting, altogether spooked, churning forelegs, keeping at bay a small gang of grooms and stable lads, all of whom were rapidly losing their professional calm at the thought of one of the king's valuable horses damaging itself before their eyes. By some miracle of stubbornness, or fear, Fergus was still in place, skinny legs flailing as he slithered and bounced on the heaving back. The grooms were all shouting at him to let go, but he ignored this advice, eyes squeezed tight shut as he clung to the two handfuls of horsehair like a lifeline. One of the grooms was carrying a pitchfork. He waved this menacingly in the air, causing a shriek of dismay from Madame Montresor, who plainly thought he meant to skewer the child. The shriek didn't ease the colt's nerves to any marked extent. It danced and skittered, backing away from the people who were beginning to surround it. While I didn't think the groom actually intended to stab Fergus off the horse's back, there was a real danger that the child would be trampled if he fell off, and I didn't see how he was going to avoid that fate for much longer. The horse made a sudden dash for a small clump of trees that grew near the paddock, either seeking shelter from the mob, or possibly having concluded that the incubus on its back might be scraped off on a branch. As it passed beneath the first branches, I caught a glimpse of red tartan among the greenery, and then there was a flash of red as Jamie launched himself from the shelter of a tree. His body struck the colt a glancing blow, and he tumbled to the ground in a flurry of played and bare legs that would have revealed to a discerning observer that this particular Scotsman wasn't wearing anything under his kilt at the moment. The party of courtiers rushed up as one, concentrating on the fallen Lord Broch Tuorc, as the grooms pursued the disappearing horse on the other side of the trees. Jamie lay flat on his back under the beech trees, his face a dead greenish-white, both eyes and mouth wide open. Both arms were locked tight around Fergus, who clung to his chest like a leech. Jamie blinked at me as I dashed up to him and made a faint effort at a smile. The faint wheezings from his open mouth deepened into a shallow panting, and I relaxed in relief. He'd only had his wind knocked out. Finally realizing that he was no longer moving, Fergus raised a cautious head. Then he sat bolt upright on his employer's stomach and said enthusiastically, "That was fun, milor. Can we do it again?" Jamie had pulled a muscle in his thigh during the rescue at Argenton, and was limping badly by the time we returned to Paris. He sent Fergus, none the worse either for the escapade or the scolding that followed it, down to the kitchen to seek his supper, and sank into a chair by the hearth, rubbing the swollen leg. "Hurt much?" I asked sympathetically.
"A bit. All it needs is rest, though."
He stood up and stretched luxuriously, long arms nearly reaching the blackened oak beams above the mantel.
cramped in that coach. I'd have sooner ridden.
So would I. I rubbed the small of my back, aching with the strain of the trip. The ache seemed to press downward through my pelvis to my legs. Joints loosening from pregnancy, I supposed. I ran an exploratory hand over Jamie's leg, then gestured to the chaise. Come and lie on your side. I've some nice ointment I can rub your leg with. It might ease the ache a bit.
Well, if you dinna mind.
He rose stiffly and lay down on his left side, kilt pulled above his knee. I opened my medicine box and rummaged through the boxes and jars. Agrimony, slippery elm, pellitory of the wall. Ah, there it was. I pulled out the small blue glass jar Monsieur Foray had given me and unscrewed the lid. I sniffed cautiously. Salves went rancid easily, but this one appeared to have a good proportion of salt mixed in for preservation. It had a nice mellow scent and was a beautiful colour, the rich yellow-white of fresh cream. I scooped out a good bit of the salve and spread it down the long muscle of the thigh, pushing Jamie's kilt above his hip to keep out of the way. The flesh of his leg was warm, not the heat of infection, only the normal heat of a young male body, flushed with exercise, and the glowing pulse of health. I massaged the cream gently into the skin, feeling the swell of the hard muscle, probing the divisions of quadriceps and hamstring. Jamie made a small grunting sound as I rubbed harder.
Hurt? I asked.
Aye, a bit. But don't stop, he answered. Feels as though it's doing me good.
He chuckled.
I wouldn't admit to any but you, Sassenach, but it was fun. I haven't a moved like that in months.
Glad you enjoyed yourself, I said dryly, taking another dab of cream. I had an interesting time myself. Not pausing in the massage, I told him of Sandringham's offer. He grunted in response, wincing slightly as I hit a tender spot.
So, Gollum was right when he thought the man might be able to help with the charges against me.
So it would seem. I suppose the question is, do you want to take him up on it?
I tried not to hold my breath as I waited for his answer. For one thing, I knew what it would be. The Frasers, as a family, were renowned for stubbornness, and despite his mother's having been a Mackenzie, Jamie was a Fraser through and through. Having made up his mind to stopping Charles Stuart, he was hardly likely to abandon the effort. Still, it was tempting bait, to me as well as to him, to be able to go back to Scotland, to his home, to live in peace. But there was another rub, of course. If we did go back, leaving Charles's plans to run their course into the future I knew, then any peace in Scotland would be short-lived indeed. Jamie gave a small snort, apparently having followed my own thought processes. Well, I'll tell you, Sassenach. If I thought that Charles Stuart might succeed, might free Scotland from English rule, then I would give my lands, my liberty, and life itself to help him. Fool he might be, but a royal fool, and not an ungallant one, I think.
He sighed.
But I know the man, and I've talked with him, and with all the Jacobites that fought with his father. And given what you tell me will happen if it comes to a rising again, I didn't see that I've any choice but to stay, Sassenach. Once he's stopped, then there may be a chance to go back. Or there may not. But for now, I must decline his grace's offer with thanks.
I patted his thigh gently. That's what I thought you'd say. He smiled at me, then glanced down at the yellowish cream that coated my fingers.
What's that stuff?
Something Monsieur Foray gave me. He didn't say what it's called. I don't think it's got any active ingredients, but it's a nice, greasy sort of cream. The body under my hand stiffened, and Jamie glanced over his shoulder at the blue jar.
Monsieur Foray gave it you,
he said uneasily.
Yes,
I answered, surprised.
What's the matter?
For he had put aside my cream-smeared hands and swinging his legs over the side of the chaise longue, was reaching for a towel.
"Has that jarred a fleur-de-lis on the lid, Sassenach?" he asked, wiping the ointment from his leg.
"Yes, it has," I said. "Jamie, what's wrong with that salve?" The look on his face was peculiar in the extreme. It kept vacillating between dismay and amusement.
"Oh, I wouldn't see there's anything wrong about it, Sassenach," he answered finally.
Having rubbed his leg hard enough to leave the curly red-gold hair bristling above reddened skin, he tossed the towel aside and looked thoughtfully at the jar.
"Monsieur Foray must think highly of you, Sassenach," he said. "It's expensive stuff, that."
"But..."
"It's not that I dinna appreciate it," he assured me hastily. "It's only that having come within a day's length of being one of the ingredients myself, it makes me feel a bit queer."
"Jamie?" I felt my voice rising.
"What is that stuff?"
I grabbed the towel, hastily swabbing my salve-coated hands.
"Hanged men's grease," he answered reluctantly.
"Ah!" I couldn't even get the word out, and started over.
"You mean..." Goosebumps rippled up my arms, raising the fine hairs like pins in a cushion. "I? Rendered fat from hanged criminals?"
He spoke cheerfully, regaining his composure as quickly as I was losing mine.
"Very good for the rheumatism and joint ill, they say."
I recalled the tidy way in which Monsieur Foray had gathered up the results of his operations in l'Hôpital des Anges, and the odd look on Jamie's face when he had seen the tall chirurgien escort me home. My knees were watery, and I felt my stomach flip like a pancake.
"Jamie, who in bloody fucking hell is Monsieur Foray?" I nearly screamed.
Amusement was definitely getting the upper hand in his expression.
"He's the public hangman for the 5th arrondissement, Sassenach. I thought you knew."
Jamie returned damp and chilled from the stable-yard where he had gone to scrub himself, the required ablutions being on a scale greater than the bedroom basin could provide.
"Don't worry, it's all off," he assured me, skinning out of his shirt and sliding naked beneath the covers.
His flesh was rough and chilly with goose flesh, and he shivered briefly as he took me in his arms.
"What is it, Sassenach? I don't still smell of it, do I?" he asked, as I huddled stiff under the bedclothes, hugging myself with my arms.
"No," I said. "I'm scared. Jamie, I'm bleeding."
"Jesus,"
he said softly. I could feel the sudden thrill of fear that ran through him at my words, identical to the one that ran through me. He held me close to him, smoothing my hair and stroking my back, but both of us felt the awful helplessness in the face of physical disaster that made his actions futile. Strong as he was, he couldn't protect me. Willing he might be, but he couldn't help. For the first time, I wasn't safe in his arms, and the knowledge terrified both of us.
"Do you think?"
he began, then broke off and swallowed. I could feel the tremor run down his throat and hear the gulp as he swallowed his fear.
"Is it bad, Sassenach? Can you tell?"
"No," I said. I held him tighter, trying to find an anchorage. "I don't know. It isn't heavy bleeding. Not yet, anyway." The candle was still alight. He looked down at me, eyes dark with worry.
"Had I better fetch someone to you, Claire? A healer? One of the women from the hôpital?"
I shook my head and licked dry lips. "No, I don't think there's anything they could do." It was the last thing I wanted to say. More than anything, I wanted there to be someone we could find who knew how to make it all right. But I remembered my early nurse's training, the few days I had spent on the obstetrical ward, and the words of one of the doctors, shrugging as he left the bed of a patient who'd had a miscarriage.
"There's really nothing you can do," he'd said. "If they're going to lose a child, they generally do, no matter what you try." Bed rest is really the only thing, and even that often won't do it.
It may be nothing, I said, trying to hearten both of us. It isn't unusual for women to have slight bleeding sometimes during pregnancy.
It wasn't unusual during the first 3 months.
I was more than 5 months along, and this was by no means usual. Still, there were many things that could cause bleeding, and not all of them were serious.
It may be all right, I said.
I laid a hand on my stomach, pressing gently. I felt an immediate response from the occupant, a lazy, stretching push that at once made me feel better. I felt a rush of passionate gratitude that made tears come to my eyes.
Sassenach, what can I do?
Jamie whispered. His hand came around me and lay over mine, cupping my threatened abdomen. I put my other hand on top of his and held on.
Just pray, I said. Pray for us, Jamie.
Chapter 23. The Best-Laid Plans of Mice and Men. The bleeding had stopped by the morning. I rose very cautiously, but all remained well. Still, it was obvious that the time had come for me to stop working at L'Hôpital des Anges, and I sent Fergus with a note of explanation and apology to Mother Hildegard. He returned with her prayers and good wishes, and a bottle of a brownish elixir, much esteemed, according to the accompanying note, by les maîtresses sages-femmes, for the prevention of miscarriage. After Monsieur Fauré's salve, I was more than a little dubious about using any medication I hadn't prepared myself. But a careful sniff reassured me that at least the ingredients were purely botanical. After a considerable hesitation, I drank a spoonful. The liquid was bitter and left a nasty taste in my mouth, but the simple act of doing something, even something I thought likely to be useless, made me feel better. I spent the greater part of each day now lying on the chaise longue in my room, reading, dozing, sewing, or simply staring into space with my hands over my belly. When I was alone, that is. When he was home, Jamie spent most of his time with me, talking over the day's business or discussing the most recent Jacobite letters. King James had apparently been told of his son's proposed investment in port wine and approved it wholeheartedly as a very sound scheme which I cannot but feel will go a great way in providing for you, as I should wish to see you, established in France. So James thinks the money's intended merely to establish Charles as a gentleman and give him some position here, I said. Do you think that could be all he has in mind? Louise was here this afternoon. She says Charles came to see her last week, insisted on seeing her, though she refused to receive him at first. She says he was very excited and puffed up about something, but he wouldn't tell her what, just kept hinting mysteriously about something great he was about to do. A great adventure is what she says, he said. That doesn't sound like a simple investment in port, does it?
That doesn't.
Jamie looked grim at the thought. I said.
Well, all things taken together, it seems a good bet that Charles isn't meaning just to settle down upon the profits of his venture and become an upstanding Paris merchant.
If I were a wagering man, I'd lay my last garter on it, Jamie said. The question now is, how do we stop him?
The answer came several days later, after any amount of discussion and useless suggestions. Murtaugh was with us in my bedroom, having brought up several bolts of cloth from the docks for me.
"They say there's been an outbreak of pox in Portugal," he observed, dumping the expensive watered silk on the bed as though it were a load of used burlap. "There was a ship carrying iron from Lisbon came in this morning, and the harbour master was over it with a toothcomb, him and three assistants. Found naught, though."
Spotting the brandy bottle on my table, he poured a tumbler half full and drank it like water in large, healthy swallows. I watched this performance open-mouthed, pulled from the spectacle only by Jamie's exclamation.
"Porks?" "Aye," said Murtagh, between swallows. "Small porks."
He lifted the glass again and resumed his systematic refreshment.
"Porks,"
Jamie muttered to himself.
"Porks."
Slowly the frown left his face and the vertical crease between his eyebrows disappeared. A deeply contemplative look came over him, and he lay back in his chair, hands linked behind his neck, staring fixedly at Myrtle. The hint of a smile twitched his wide mouth sideways. Murtagh observed this process with considerable sceptical resignation. He drained his cup and sat stolidly hunched on his stool as Jamie sprang to his feet and began circling the little clansman, whistling tunelessly through his teeth.
"I take it you have an idea," I said.
"Ooh, aye,"
he said, and began to laugh softly to himself.
"Ooh, aye, that I have."
He turned to me, eyes alight with mischief and inspiration.
"Have you anything in your box of medicines that would make a man feverish, or give him flux, or sports?"
"Well, yes," I said slowly, thinking. "There's rosemary, or cayenne, and cascara, of course, for diarrhea. Why?" He looked at Murtagh, grinning widely. Then, overcome with his idea, cackled and ruffled his kinsman's hair so it stuck up in black spikes. Murtagh glared at him, exhibiting a strong resemblance to Louise's pet monkey.
"Listen,"
Jamie said, bending toward us conspiratorially.
"What if the Comte Saint-Germain's ship comes back from Portugal with pox aboard?"
I stared at him. "Have you lost your mind?" I inquired politely. "What if it did?"
"If it did," Murtagh interrupted, "they'd lose the cargo. It would be burnt or dumped in the harbour by law."
A gleam of interest showed in the small black eyes.
"And how do you mean to manage that, lad?"
Jamie's exhilaration dropped slightly, though the light in his eyes remained.
"Well," he admitted, "I haven't got it thought out all the way as yet, but for a start..."
The plan took several days of discussion and research to refine, but was at last settled. Cascara to cause flux had been rejected as being too debilitating in action. However, I'd found some good substitutes in one of the herbals Master Raymond had lent me. Murtagh, armed with a pouch full of rosemary essence, nettle juice, and madder root, would set out at the end of the week for Lisbon, where he would gossip among the sailors' taverns, find out the ship chartered by the Comte Saint-Germain, and arrange to take passage on it, meanwhile sending back word of the ship's name and sailing date to Paris.
"No, that's common," said Jamie, in answer to my question as to whether the captain might not find this behaviour fishy. "Almost all cargo ships carry a few passengers, however many they can squeeze between decks, and Murtagh will have enough money to make him a welcome addition, even if they have to give him the captain's cabin."
He wagged an admonitory finger at Murtagh.
"And get a cabin, d'ye hear? I don't care what it costs. You'll need privacy for taking the herbs, and we dinna want the chance of someone seeing you, if you've naught but a hammock slung in the bilges."
He surveyed his godfather with a critical eye.
"Have you a decent coat? If you go aboard looking like a beggar, they're like to hurl you off into the harbour before they find out what you've got in your sporran."
"Mm-hmm," said Murtagh.
The little clansman usually contributed little to the discussion, but what he did say was cogent and to the point.
"And when do I take the stuff?" he asked.
I pulled out the sheet of paper on which I had written the instructions and dosages. 2 spoonfuls of the rose madder, that's this one. I tapped the small clear glass bottle, filled with a dark pinkish fluid. To be taken 4 hours before you plan to demonstrate your symptoms. Take another spoonful every 2 hours after the first dose. We don't know how long you'll have to keep it up. I handed him the second bottle, this one of green glass filled with a purplish-black liquor. This is concentrated essence of rosemary leaves. This one acts faster. Drink about one quarter of the bottle half an hour before you mean to show yourself. You should start flushing within half an hour. It wears off quickly, so you'll need to take more when you can manage inconspicuously. I took another, smaller vial from my medicine box. And once you're well advanced with the fever, then you can rub the nettle juice on your arms and face to raise blisters. Do you want to keep these instructions? He shook his head decidedly.
Nay, I'll remember. There's more risk to being found with the people than there is to forgetting how much to take.
He turned to Jamie.
And you'll meet the ship at Orvieto, lad.
Jamie nodded.
Aye. She's bound to make port there. All the wine haulers do to take on fresh water. If by chance she doesn't do so, then...
He shrugged.
I shall hire a boat and try to catch her up. So long as I board her before we reach Le Havre, it should be all right. But best if we can do it while we're still close off the coast of Spain. I dinna mean to spend longer at sea than I must.
He pointed with his chin at the bottle in Murtaugh's hand.
You'd best wait to take the stuff till you see me come on board. With no witnesses, the captain might take the easy way out and just put ye astern in the night.
Murtaugh grunted.
Aye, he might try.
He touched the hilt of his dirk, and there was just the faintest ironic emphasis on the word try. Jamie frowned at him.
Dinna forget yourself. You're meant to be suffering from the pox. With luck, they'll be afraid to touch you, but just in case, wait till I'm within call and we're well offshore.
I looked from one to the other of the two men. Far-fetched as it was, it might conceivably work. If the captain of the ship could be convinced that one of his passengers was infected with smallpox, he would under no circumstances take his ship into the harbour at Le Havre, where the French health restrictions would require its destruction. And faced with the necessity of sailing back with his cargo to Lisbon and losing all profit on the voyage, or losing 2 weeks at Orvieto while word was sent to Paris, he might very well instead consent to sell the cargo to the wealthy Scottish merchant who had just come aboard. The impersonation of a smallpox victim was the crucial role in this masquerade. Jamie had volunteered to be the guinea pig for testing the herbs, and they had worked magnificently on him. His fair skin had flushed dark red within minutes, and the nettle juice raised immediate blisters that could easily be mistaken for those of pox by a ship's doctor or a panicked captain. And should any doubt remain, the madder-stained urine gave an absolutely perfect illusion of a man pissing blood as the smallpox attacked his kidneys.
"Christ!"
Jamie had exclaimed, startled despite himself at the first demonstration of the herb's efficacy.
"Oh, jolly good," I said, peering over his shoulder at the white porcelain chamber pot and its crimson contents.
"That's better than I expected."
"Oh, aye. How long does it take to wear off, then?"
Jamie had asked, looking down rather nervously.
"A few hours, I think," I told him.
"Why? Does it feel odd?"
"Not odd exactly," he said, rubbing. "It itches a bit." "That's no the herb," Murtaugh interjected dourly. "It's just the natural condition for a lad of your age."
Jamie grinned at his godfather.
"Remember that far back, do you? Farther back than you were born or thought of, laddie,"
Murtaugh had said, shaking his head. The little clansman now stowed the vials in his sporran, methodically wrapping each one in a bit of soft leather to prevent breakage.
"I'll send word of the ship and her sailing so soon as I may, and I'll see you within the month off Spain. You'll have the money before then."
Jamie nodded.
"Oh, aye, by next week, I imagine."
Jared's business had prospered under Jamie's stewardship, but the cash reserves were not sufficient to purchase entire shiploads of port while still fulfilling the other commitments of the House of Fraser. The chess games had borne fruit in more than one regard, though, and Monsieur Duvigny the younger, a prominent banker, had willingly guaranteed a sizable loan for his father's friend.
"'It's a pity we can't bring the stuff into Paris,' Jamie had remarked during the planning. "'But Saint-Germain would be sure to find out. "'I expect we'll do best to sell it through a broker in Spain. "'I know a good man in Bilbao. "'The profit will be much smaller than it would be in France, "'and the taxes are higher. "'But you cannot have everything, can you?'
"'I'll settle for paying back Duvernay's loan,' I said. "'And speaking of loans, "'what's Signor Manzetti going to do about the money he's loaned Charles Stuart?'
"'Hustle for it, I expect,' said Jamie cheerfully, "'and ruin the Stuart's reputation with every banker on the continent while he's about it.'
"'Seems a bit hard on poor old Manzetti,' I observed.
"'I will. You can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, as my old granny says.'
"'You haven't got an old granny,' I pointed out.
"'No,' he admitted. "'But if I had, that's what she'd see.'
"'He had dropped the playfulness then, momentarily.
"'It's no very fair to the Stuarts forby. "'In fact, should any of the Jacobite lords come to know what I've been doing, "'I expect they'd call it treason, and they'd be right.'
"'He rubbed a hand over his brow and shook his head.' "'And I saw the deadly seriousness that his playfulness covered.
"'It canna be helped, Sassenach. "'If you're right, and I've staked my life so far on it, "'then it's a choice between the aspirations of Charles Stuart "'and the lives of a hell of a lot of Scotsmen. "'I've no love for King Geordie, me with a price on my head, "'but I dinna see that I can do otherwise.'
"'He frowned. "'Running a hand through his hair as he always did when thinking or upset. "'If there were a chance of Charles succeeding...
"'Aye, well, that might be different.
"'To take a risk in an honourable cause.
"'But your history says he wouldna succeed, "'and I must say, all I know of the man makes it seem likely that you're right.
"'They're my folk and my family at stake.' "'And if the cost of their lives is a banker's gold,
"'well, it doesn't seem more a sacrifice than that of my own honour.'
"'He shrugged in half-humorous despair.
"'So, now I've gone from stealing His Highness's mail "'to bank robbery and piracy on the high seas, "'and it seems there's nae help for it.'
"'He was silent for a moment, looking down at his hands, "'clenched together on the desk.' Then he turned his head to me and smiled.
"'I always wanted to be a pirate when I was a bairn,' he said. "'Pretty I canna wear a cutlass.'
I lay in bed, head and shoulders propped on pillows, hands clasped lightly over my stomach, thinking. Since the first alarm there had been very little bleeding, and I felt well. Still, any sort of bleeding at this stage was cause for alarm. I wondered privately what would happen if any emergency arose while Jamie was gone to Spain, but there was little to be gained by worrying. He had to go. There was too much riding on that particular shipload of wine for any private concerns to intrude. And if everything went all right, he should be back well before the baby was due. As it was, all personal concerns would have to be put aside, danger or no. Charles, unable to contain his own excitement, had confided to Jamie that he would shortly require two ships, possibly more, and had asked his advice on hull design and the mounting of deck cannon. His father's most recent letters from Rome had betrayed a slight tone of questioning. With his acute Bourbon nose for politics, James Stuart smelled a rat, but plainly hadn't yet been informed of what his son was up to. Jamie, hip deep in decoded letters, thought it likely that Philip of Spain hadn't yet mentioned Charles' overtures or the Pope's interest, but James Stuart had his spies as well. After a little while, I became aware of some slight change in Jamie's attitude. Glancing toward him, I saw that while he was still holding a book open on his knee, he had ceased to turn the pages, or to look at them for that matter. His eyes were fixed on me instead, or, to be specific, on the spot where my nightrobe parted, several inches lower than strict modesty might dictate, strict modesty hardly seeming necessary in bed with one's husband. His gaze was abstracted, dark blue with longing, and I realized that if not socially required, modesty in bed with one's husband might be at least considerate under the circumstances. There were alternatives, of course. Catching me looking at him, Jamie blushed slightly and hastily returned to an exaggerated interest in his book. I rolled onto my side and rested a hand on his thigh. "Interesting book," I asked, idly caressing him.
"Mm-hmm. Oh, aye."
The blush deepened, but he didn't take his eyes from the page. Grinning to myself, I slipped my hand under the bedclothes. He dropped the book.
"Sassenach," he said. "You know you canna."
"No," I said, "but you can. Or rather, I can for you." He firmly detached my hand and gave it back to me.
"No, Sassenach, it wouldna be right."
"It wouldn't," I said, surprised. "Why ever not?" He squirmed uncomfortably, avoiding my eyes.
"Well, I wouldn't feel right, Sassenach, to take my pleasure from you and not be able to give you...
Well,
I wouldn't feel right about it, is all."
I burst into laughter, laying my head on his thigh. "Jamie, you are too sweet for words."
"I am not sweet," he said indignantly, "but I'm no such a selfish. Claire, stop that."
"You were planning to wait several more months?" I asked, not stopping.
"I could," he said,
with what dignity was possible under the circumstances.
"I waited 22 years, and I can..."
"No, you can't," I said, pulling back the bedclothes and admiring the shape so clearly visible beneath his nightshirt. I touched it, and it moved slightly, eager against my hand.
"Whatever God meant you to be, Jamie Fraser, it wasn't a monk."
With a sure hand, I pulled up his nightshirt.
"But,"
he began. "Two against one," I said, leaning down. "You lose." Jamie worked hard for the next few days, readying the wine business to look after itself during his absence. Still, he found time to come up and sit with me for a short time after lunch most days, and so it was that he was with me when a visitor was announced. Visitors were not uncommon. Louise came every other day or so to chatter about pregnancy or to moan over her lost love, though I privately thought she enjoyed Charles a great deal more as the object of noble renunciation than she did as a present lover. She had promised to bring me some Turkish sweetmeats, and I rather expected her plump pink face to peek through the door. To my surprise, though, the visitor was Monsieur Foret. Magnus himself showed him into my sitting room, taking his hat and cloak with an almost superstitious reverence. Jamie looked surprised at this visitation, but rose to his feet to greet the hangman politely and offer him refreshment.
"As a general rule, I take no spirits,"
Monsieur Foret said with a smile.
"But I would not insult the hospitality of my esteemed colleague."
He bowed ceremoniously in the direction of the chaise where I reclined.
"You are well, I trust, Madame Fraser?"
"Yes," I said cautiously. "Thank you." I wondered to what we owed the honour of the visit. For while Monsieur Foret enjoyed considerable prestige and a fair amount of wealth in return for his official duties, I didn't think his job got him many dinner invitations. I wondered suddenly whether Hangman had any social life to speak of. He crossed the room and laid a small package on the chaise beside me, rather like a fatherly vulture bringing home dinner for his chicks. Keeping in mind the hanged men's grease, I picked the package up gingerly and weighed it in my hand, light for its size and smelling faintly astringent.
"A small remembrance from Mother Hildegard," he explained. "I understand it is a favourite remedy of les maîtresses sages-femmes. She has written directions for its use as well."
He withdrew a folded sealed note from his inner pocket and handed it over. I sniffed the package. raspberry leaves and saxifrage. Something else I didn't recognise. I hoped Mother Hildegard had included a list of the ingredients as well. "Please thank Mother Hildegard for me," I said. "And how is everyone at the hôpital?" I greatly missed my work there, as well as the nuns and the odd assortment of medical practitioners. We gossiped for some time about the hôpital and its personnel, with Jamie contributing the occasional comment, but usually just listening with a polite smile, or, when the subject turned to the clinical, burying his nose in his glass of wine. "What a pity," I said regretfully, as Monsieur Foret finished his description of the repair of a crushed shoulder blade. "I've never seen that done. I do miss the surgical work."
"Yes, I will miss it as well,"
Monsieur Foret nodded, taking a small sip from his wine glass. It was still more than half full. Apparently he hadn't been joking about his abstention from spirits.
"You're leaving Paris?" Jamie said in some surprise.
Monsieur Foret shrugged, the folds of his long coat rustling like feathers.
"Only for a time," he said. "Still, I will be gone for at least 2 months. In fact, madame,"
he bowed his head toward me again,
"that is the main reason for my visit today."
"It is?"
"Yes. I am going to England, you understand. And it occurred to me that if you wished it, madame, it would be a matter of the greatest simplicity for me to carry any message that you desired. Should there be anyone with whom you wish to communicate, that is,"
he added, with his usual precision. I glanced at Jamie, whose face had suddenly altered from an open expression of polite interest to that pleasantly smiling mask that hid all thoughts. A stranger wouldn't have noticed the difference, but I did. "No," I said hesitantly. "I have no friends or relatives in England. I'm afraid I have no connections there at all since I was widowed." I felt the usual small stab at this reference to Frank, but suppressed it. If this seemed odd to Monsieur Foret, he didn't show it. He merely nodded and set down his half-drunk glass of wine.
"I see. It is fortunate indeed that you have friends here, then."
His voice seemed to hold a warning of some kind, but he didn't look at me as he bent to straighten his stocking before rising.
"I shall call upon you on my return, then, and hope to find you again in good health." "What is the business that takes you to England, monsieur?"
Jamie said bluntly. Monsieur Foret turned to him with a faint smile. He cocked his head, eyes bright, and I was struck once more by his resemblance to a large bird. Not a carrion crow at the moment, though, but a raptor, a bird of prey.
"And what business should a man of my profession travel on, Monsieur Fraser?" he asked. "I have been hired to perform my usual duties at Smithfield." "An important occasion, I take it," said Jamie. "To justify the summoning of a man of your skill, I mean."
His eyes were watchful, though his expression showed nothing beyond polite inquiry. Monsieur Foret's eyes grew brighter. He rose slowly to his feet, looking down at Jamie, where he sat near the window.
"That is true, Monsieur Fraser," he said softly. "For it is a matter of skill, make no mistake. To choke a man to death at the end of a rope... Pah! Anyone can do that. To break a neck cleanly, with one quick fall, that requires some calculation in terms of weight and drop, and a certain amount of practice in the placing of the rope as well. But to walk the line between these methods, to properly execute the sentence of a traitor's death, that requires great skill indeed."
My mouth felt suddenly dry, and I reached for my own glass. "A traitor's death," I said, feeling as though I really didn't want to hear the answer.
"Hanging, drawing, and quartering," Jamie said briefly. "That is what you mean, of course, Monsieur Foret."
The hangman nodded. Jamie rose to his feet, as though against his will, facing the gaunt, black-clad visitor. They were much of a height and could look each other in the face without difficulty. Monsieur Foret took a step toward Jamie, expression suddenly abstracted, as though he were about to make a demonstration of some medical point.
"Oh, yes," he said. "Yes, that is the traitor's death. First, the man must be hanged, as you say, but with a nice judgment, so that the neck is not broken, nor the windpipe crushed. Suffocation is not the desired result, you understand."
"Oh, I understand."
Jamie's voice was soft, with an almost mocking edge, and I glanced at him in bewilderment.
"Do you, monsieur?"
Monsieur Foret smiled faintly, but went on without waiting for an answer.
"It is a matter of timing, then. You judge by the eyes. The face will darken with blood almost immediately, more quickly if the subject is of fair complexion. And as choking proceeds, the tongue is forced from the mouth. That is what delights the crowds, of course, as well as the popping eyes. But you watch for the signs of redness at the corners of the eyes, as the small blood vessels burst. When that happens, you must give at once the signal for the subject to be cut down. A dependable assistant is indispensable, you understand."
He half turned to include me in this macabre conversation, and I nodded, despite myself.
"Then," he continued, turning back to Jamie, "you must administer at once a stimulant to revive the subject while the shirt is being removed. You must insist that a shirt opening down the front is provided. Often it is difficult to get them off over the head."
One long, slender finger reached out, pointing at the middle button of Jamie's shirt, but not quite touching the fresh, starched linen.
"I would suppose so," Jamie said.
Monsieur Foret retracted the finger, nodding in approval at this evidence of comprehension.
"Just so. The assistant will have kindled the fire beforehand. This is beneath the dignity of the executioner. And then the time of the knife is at hand."
There was a dead silence in the room. Jamie's face was still set in inscrutability, but a slight moisture gleamed on the side of his neck.
"It is here that the utmost of skills is required," Monsieur Foret explained, raising a finger in admonition. "You must work quickly, lest the subject expire before you have finished. Mixing a dose with a stimulant which constricts the blood vessels will give you a few moments' grace, but not much."
Spotting a silver letter opener on the table, he crossed to it and picked it up. He held it with his hand wrapped about the hilt, forefinger braced on top of the blade, pointed down at the shining walnut of the tabletop.
"Just there," he said,
almost dreamily.
"At the base of the breastbone, and quickly to the crest of the groin. You can see the bone easily in most cases." "Again?"
And the letter opener flashed to one side, and then the other, quick and delicate as the zigzag flight of a hummingbird.
"Following the arch of the ribs. You must not cut deeply, for you do not wish to puncture the sac which encloses the entrails. Still, you must get through skin, fat, and muscle, and do it with one stroke."
"This," he said with satisfaction, gazing down at his own reflection in the tabletop,
"is artistry."
He laid the knife gently on the table and turned back to Jamie. He shrugged pleasantly.
"After that, it is a matter of speed and some dexterity. But if you have been exact in your methods, it will present little difficulty. The entrails are sealed within a membrane, you see, resembling a bag. If you have not severed this by accident, it is a simple matter, needing only a little strength to force your hands beneath the muscular layer and pull free the entire mass. A quick cut at stomach and anus."
He glanced disparagingly at the letter opener.
"And then the entrails may be thrown upon the fire. Now,"
he raised an admonitory finger,
"if you have been swift and delicate in your work, there is now a moment's leisure. For, mark you,
as yet no large vessels will have been severed.
I felt quite faint, although I was sitting down, and I was sure that my face was as white as Jamie's. Pale as he was, Jamie smiled, as though humouring a guest in conversation.
So the subject can live a bit longer.
Mais oui, monsieur.
The hangman's bright black eyes swept over Jamie's powerful frame, taking in the width of shoulder and the muscular legs.
The effects of such shock are unpredictable, but I have seen a strong man live for more than a quarter of an hour in this state.
I imagine it seems a lot longer to the subject, Jamie said dryly.
Monsieur Fauré appeared not to hear this, picking up the letter opener again and flourishing it as he spoke.
As death approaches, then you must reach up into the cavity of the body to grasp the heart. Here, skill is called upon again. The heart retracts, you see, without the downward anchorage of the viscera, and often it is surprisingly far up. In addition, it is most slippery.
He wiped one hand on the skirt of his coat in pantomime.
But the major difficulty lies in severing the large vessels above very quickly, so that the organ may be pulled forth while still beating. You wish to please the crowd, he explained. It makes a great difference to the remuneration.
As to the rest...
He shrugged a lean, disdainful shoulder.
Mere butchery. Once life is extinct, there is no further need of skill.
No, I suppose not, I said faintly.
But you are pale, madame. I have detained you far too long in tedious conversation, he exclaimed.
He reached for my hand, and I resisted the very strong urge to yank it back. His own hand was cool, but the warmth of his lips as he brushed his mouth lightly across my hand was so unexpected that I tightened my own grasp in surprise. He gave my hand a slight invisible squeeze and turned to bow formally to Jamie.
I must take my leave, Monsieur Fraser. I shall hope to meet you and your charming wife again, under such pleasant circumstances as we have enjoyed today.
The eyes of the two men met for a second. Then Monsieur Fauré appeared to recall the letter opener he was still holding in one hand. With an exclamation of surprise, he held it out on his open palm. Jamie arched one brow and picked the knife up delicately by the point.
"Bon voyage, Monsieur Fauré," he said. "And I thank you,"
his mouth twisted wryly,
"for your most instructive visit."
He insisted upon seeing our visitor to the door himself. Left alone, I got up and went to the window, where I stood practicing deep breathing exercises until the dark blue carriage disappeared around the corner of the Rue Gamboge. The door opened behind me, and Jamie stepped in. He still held the letter opener. He crossed deliberately to the large Famille Rose jar that stood by the hearth, and dropped the paper knife into it with a clang, then turned to me, doing his best to smile.
"Well, as warnings go," he said, "that one was very effective."
I shuddered briefly. "Wasn't it, though?"
"Who do you think sent him?"
Jamie asked.
"Mother Hildegard."
"I expect so. She warned me when we decoded the music. She said what you were doing was dangerous." The fact of just how dangerous had been lost upon me until the hangman's visit. I hadn't suffered from morning nausea for some time, but I felt my gorge rising now.
If the Jacobite lords knew what I was doing, they'd call it treason.
And what steps might they take if they did find out? To all outward intents, Jamie was an avowed Jacobite supporter. In that guise, he visited Charles, entertained the Earl Marischal to dinner, and attended court. And so far, he had been skilful enough in his chess games, his tavern visits, and his drinking parties to undercut the Stuart cause while seeming outwardly to support it. Besides the two of us, only Murtaugh knew that we sought to thwart a Stuart rising, and even he didn't know why, merely accepting his chief's word that it was right. That pretense was necessary while operating in France. But the same pretense would brand Jamie a traitor should he ever set foot on English soil. I had known that, of course.